This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yeis Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
French President François Hollande says no hypothesis has been ruled out in the crash of a Cairo-bound Egypt Air flight from Paris, as experts say a terrorist attack may be one likely scenario.
That's Lisa Bryant reporting from the French capital. Details coming up.
Also, the Nigeria schoolgirl rescued from Boko Haram militants after 2 years of captivity met today with President Buhari. And a rights group is raising the alarm about conditions in detention centers for migrants and refugees on three Greek islands.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Egypt Air says wreckage has been found from its passenger plane that crashed today in the Mediterranean. It's not clear what part of the plane was spotted, but the search continues for other debris. Greece is helping in the search for flight MS-804. There were 66 people aboard flight en route from Paris to Cairo. Egypt's aviation minister says the crash was more likely caused by a terrorist attack than by a technical failure. Greek civil aviation officials in Athens say that the plane went down south of the Greek island of Karpathos, as Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Several relatives of the passengers of the doomed Egypt Air passenger jet cried as they walked outside the Cairo Airport Terminal building, where relatives were meeting with doctors and airline personnel. A somber mood prevailed in the streets of the Egyptian capital as word that wreckage from the flight from Paris to Cairo had been found by Greek rescue vessels not far from the coast of Crete. Residents of Cairo tell VOA that they suspect that the plane was brought down by an act of terrorism. Egypt's civil aviation minister, Sharif Fathi, said France would be responsible for any security lapse if terrorism is confirmed to be the cause of the crash.
If it's proven that this was an act of sabotage, then we have to know and recognize that this plane originated from France, not from Egypt.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi met with top officials Thursday morning to discuss the information that was filtering in about the Egypt Air plane and how to react. Egyptian officials said privately that they were concerned that bad publicity about the crash could further impact the country's already fragile tourism sector. A Russian Metrojet plane crashed over the Sinai last October, causing both Russia and Britain to suspend flights to the Sinai resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. Another Egypt Air domestic flight was hijacked to Cyprus in March. Terrorist attacks in the Egyptian resort towns of Luxor and Hurghada last year have also impacted negatively on the tourism sector. Islamic militant groups have been active in most of Egypt's neighbors, and both Al-Qaeda and Islamic State affiliates in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and Tunisia have perpetrated powerful waves of suicide attacks in recent days and weeks. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
French President François Hollande says no hypothesis has been ruled out in the crash of the Cairo-bound Egypt flight from Paris, as experts say a terrorist attack is one likely scenario. Lisa Bryant has more from the French capital, where questions may point to airport security.
France has set up an emergency hotline for loved ones of those aboard Egypt Air flight MS-804 that disappeared from radar screens early Thursday, several hours after taking off from the Charles de Gaulle Airport outside Paris. Officials say 15 French nationals were on board, along with 30 Egyptians and nationals from about 10 other countries.
Les informations que nous avons pu recueillir, le Premier ministre, les membres du gouvernement, et bien sûr...
Speaking on national TV, French President François Hollande confirmed the plane had been damaged and lost. He said no hypothesis has been ruled out, whether this was an accident or a terrorist attack. He said the French government is in contact with Egyptian and Greek authorities to help in the search mission. Egypt Air said it lost contact with the Airbus A320 at about 2:30 a.m. Cairo time, when the airliner was at an altitude of nearly 11,300 meters and just 16 kilometers inside Egyptian airspace. Greece's defense minister said the flight made abrupt turns and suddenly lost altitude before vanishing from radar. If the investigation points to a possible terrorist attack, questions will likely point to Charles de Gaulle Airport security, which has been considered good and was boosted after the attacks in Paris and Brussels. Some Charles de Gaulle staff have been on a partial strike this week. Last year, dozens of airport staff had their passes withdrawn over fears of radicalization. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The first of the Chibok girls rescued from Nigeria's Boko Haram militants appeared before journalists in the capital Abuja today. VOA's Chris Stein was there and reports.
Amina Ali arrived with her mother, her crying infant, and a nurse at the Aso Rock presidential villa Thursday afternoon. She was greeted by governors, cabinet ministers, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, and dozens of camera-wielding journalists. Ali said nothing during the news conference that followed, sitting slumped in a chair while a nurse held her baby. Buhari vowed the government will take care of Ali.
We'll ensure that she gets the best medical, psychological, emotional, and whatever other care she requires to make a full recovery and be integrated fully into the society.
Boko Haram militants abducted Ali and the other schoolgirls from the northeastern town of Chibok a little more than 2 years ago. Activists have been calling for Nigeria's government to rescue the schoolgirls ever since. Thus far, Ali is the only one of the girls who has returned to society. Kashim Shetima, governor of Borno State, where Chibok is located, confirmed that Ali was found in a village near the town of Damboa by the civilian JTF, a vigilante group set up to help the military fight Boko Haram. Shetima said Ali's recovery was a sign of good things to come.
218 girls are still unaccounted for. But the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. And the recovery of Amina Ali is a good omen.
It's likely that not all of the schoolgirls will be rescued. Ali has told villagers that six of her classmates died in captivity. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
In Catania, Sicily, a Tunisian ship captain is being tried this week for the deaths of 800 migrants. They drowned when their boat sank off the Libyan coast last April. Prosecutors are asking for 18-year sentences for the captain and his Syrian assistant. Also today, the 28 NATO members have begun a two-day meeting in Brussels. They're discussing military measures to stop the smuggling of migrants and refugees from Libya to Italy. And Greek police fired tear gas and stun grenades yesterday on about 200 migrants who tried to escape an overcrowded camp in Idomeni on the Macedonian border. There are about 10,000 people in the makeshift camp. Macedonia has closed its border to the refugees, blocking the Balkans' route to Western Europe.
A rights group is raising the alarm about conditions in detention centers for migrants and refugees on three Greek islands. The centers were once camps run by humanitarian organizations. That ended when the European Union and Turkey reached a deal to sharply reduce the flow of refugees to Greece. Human Rights Watch visited the centers on Samos, Lesbos, and Chios. This month, it says it found unsafe, unsanitary, and violent conditions. HRW called on Greek and European Union authorities to ensure the security of women and children. Eva Kosei is the group's researcher for Greece. From Athens, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Well, we've been working on Greece and the refugee crisis for over a year now, and we've been visiting the islands to assess the situation many times. So now we decided to visit the islands' hotspots after they became closed centers. What we found is an urgent need from the people to speak about the fear and the violence that they're going through there, and particularly women and children. What we found there was overcrowding, really abysmal conditions, and lack of basic rights, such as the right to health, access to food. We found hundreds of people sleeping on the ground without any proper shelter, in tents, in unsanitary conditions. We found really dirty toilets and bathrooms, no water, etc. But the most important thing that we found is that there are daily fights and violence and tensions, and the victims of these tensions and this violence are particularly women and children.
Now, these detention centers used to be camps that actually provided humanitarian care for the migrants.
Yes, exactly. So before the agreement between the European Union and Turkey, these were open camps for registration, and these were camps where many non-governmental organizations were providing services and humanitarian assistance. But once the deal was agreed, many organizations, in line with their policies, withdrew from these centers because these centers were transformed into detention centers. And as a consequence, we've seen that the situation has deteriorated. People don't have information about their faith, about why they are there, how long they're going to be detained, what will happen with their asylum application, etc. And this creates tensions.
You had mentioned that there were a number of violent incidents on these islands. Can you give me some examples?
Yes. So, for example, incidents of fights at the queues for food. This is a daily phenomenon in all the centers. We found on the Lesbos hotspot detention center 16-year-old and 17-year-old unaccompanied children who normally should have been in a separate place, but they were sleeping with the general population. And they told us how hard it was for them to eat food, actually, during the first few days they were there, because the queues are huge and there are fights and it's dangerous. Fights for the spot, you know, who is first, who came after, and these kind of things. As a consequence, a few days before our interview, there was a big fight and people fall onto them. One of them had serious injury on his knee and on his hand. This is one example. Other examples are the day that we visited the Samos hotspot. It was one day after a huge fight broke out among approximately 200 single men of different nationalities. The situation in the camp was really horrible. Everything was destroyed. Women were crying. We spoke to two Eritrean women who told us that every night men are drinking and are trying to enter their tent to abuse them, and the police is doing nothing. The police, when there are these kind of fights, they are withdrawing in their compounds and not protecting people, and this is very serious.
Now, since March 20th, as you mentioned, when the deal took effect between the EU and Turkey, anyone landing on these Greek islands was detained rather than being helped.
Everyone arriving after March 20th is automatically detained on those camps. Automatic detention shouldn't be applied. It's illegal. And there should be an individual assessment for each person's detention.
So what would Human Rights Watch like to see Greece and the European Union do on these islands?
Turn all these camps into open registration centers. Things were not perfect before, but at least there were humanitarian organizations providing services, and we didn't see sexual harassment, violence in so frequent ways. So we're calling on Greece to open the camps and to stop automatically detaining everyone arriving on the islands. Second, of course, it's very important to provide for separate shelter and separate compounds for single women, families, and unaccompanied children. They should be separated from men. And there needs, for example, separate, safe toilets and bathrooms so that women don't fear going to the bathroom because men are sitting next to them.
Eva Kosei is the researcher for Greece for Human Rights Watch. From Athens, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Pope Francis today condemned those who exploit the poor, calling them bloodsuckers. He said, those who make slaves of their workers through unfair contracts are committing a mortal sin. The pontiff made the comments while saying mass at his Santa Marta residence. He condemned those, he says, who are willing to starve people for profit. He said it often happens in rich countries. Pope Francis gave the example of a migrant girl who worked 11-hour days and was paid $729 a month. That's $23 per day.
In the U.S. state of Rhode Island, an effort is underway to ban the use of cruel training devices on elephants in traveling shows. Among the instruments that would be banned are bull hooks, ankus, baseball bats, axe handles, and pitchforks. They cause great pain and are used to train animals or control their behavior. An animal welfare and wildlife conservation group, Born Free USA, testified yesterday in support of the ban in Rhode Island. Adam M. Roberts is the group's CEO. He spoke with me about the importance of the bill and what it would mean for other states that use elephants in their shows.
Well, I think it's really important that we do two things. One is Born Free USA wants to make sure that elephants and other wild animals around the country are protected from cruel training techniques like the use of the bull hook or the ankus, which is basically a long stick with a metal spike at the end that's used to, quote-unquote, train elephants to perform. So it's really important that at the heart of our life of entertainment in America that we don't include animal cruelty. But then specifically in terms of the bill being heard this week in Providence, Rhode Island, to stop these cruel training methods and the use of these weapons, I think it's also important that around the country you're seeing this groundswell of support for local ordinance and state bills to try and do this very thing, protect wild animals from cruel entertainment.
Also, just to give our audience an idea of how this bull hook is actually used, can you explain a little bit more how the trainers actually use it?
Sure. So as I say, they're using this tool called a bull hook. Now, they will use other things. They'll chain elephants. They'll use other forms of sticks or baseball bats. But mostly they use this bull hook, this long stick with the metal spike at the end. And I think people think of elephants as being huge with really thick, tough skin. But the fact is, the elephant skin is actually rather sensitive. So when the trainer who's forcing the elephant to perform unnatural tricks wants to teach them to do that, and they're not willing to do so with positive reinforcement, they use the bull hook. They spike the end of the bull hook up under the elephant's armpit, which is very sensitive. They use it to tug behind the elephant's ear. Or in some video cases we've seen, they actually hit the elephant on the leg with the bull hook. And of course, this is going to cause incredible pain, suffering, leading to open wounds and bleeding. There have even been instances of elephants actually bleeding on the performance floor from being struck.
The Ringling Brothers Circus is ending its use of elephants in their shows. So are other circuses following in this vein?
I think you're going to see that the Ringling decision to actually take all of its elephants out of performance is, again, part of this trend. You've got SeaWorld saying it's as of 2019, they're no longer going to have performing orcas at their facilities in America. Ringling going out of the performing elephant business. I think that's going to be the trend, especially when we all know that there are other forms of attractions, including circuses like Cirque du Soleil or ones that only use human performers that will not involve that kind of cruelty, but also can entertain audiences everywhere. So the Ringling decision is definitely, we think, the beginning of the snowball toward the end of all elephants performing in America.
If the bill to ban the use of bull hooks does pass in Rhode Island, then what does this mean for other states?
I think it's going to show that there's a groundswell of support, and we've got other bills pending in places like California. But, you know, it usually only takes one state or one community to make this kind of humane decision. And once compassionate legislation is passed, people will see that it is possible to do so. I think for so many years, people felt that it was impossible to do this kind of thing because the circus industry was so powerful and their lobbyists were so well funded. But now that we know that there's this groundswell of support, we know that there are local ordinances being passed around the country, I think we're going to start to see state and eventually maybe even federal action as well.
That was Adam M. Roberts, CEO of Born Free USA. He spoke with me from Washington.
To Two South Sudanese rights groups say no one is being held responsible for the wave of rapes and other sexual crimes in South Sudan since the country's conflict began in late 2013. VOA's Jill Craig files from Nairobi with additional reporting from Juba by Jason Patinkin.
Annette is a first responder helping rape victims among women sheltering at a UN base in Juba, the South Sudanese capital. Annette, who prefers to be identified by first name only, says the number of rape cases each month has skyrocketed since 2013.
Before, it used to happen, but it wasn't so rampant like that. Cases would come, but in a month you'd find that only one, two, or even none. You know? But now again, like for this period, it has increased. A month, I would say an average of 30 to 40.
Annette's experience is a reflection of the sexual and gender-based violence taking place across the country. And according to Legal Action Worldwide and the South Sudan Law Society, members of security or militia groups are responsible for much of the violence. David Deng is the research director of the South Sudan Law Society.
I think evidence points to its use as a way of punishing communities, so collective punishment. And this is on all sides, you know, whether communities feel as though they're doing it to defend the rights of their communities or sort of as a more proactive punishment.
The South Sudan Law Society and Legal Action Worldwide released a report on sexual violence in South Sudan Thursday in Nairobi. The report says government and rebel forces, militias aligned to both sides, and unidentified uniformed men are reported to have committed rape, gang rape, murder, abduction, sexual assault, stripping, sexual slavery, castration, and forced abortion. Men, women, and children have all been victimized, particularly in Unity State, although women and girls are most at risk. Another group, the South Sudan Protection Cluster, says there were 1,300 rapes and 1,600 abductions of women and children between April and September of 2015. But verifying this number and figures released by other organizations is problematic, says Deng.
We don't even have any information on the basis of this figure. You know, it's just these figures which are seemingly pulled out of thin air, and there's no really way to assess the credibility of them.
South Sudan lacks a formal justice system that is accessible to the wider population. Traditional justice systems may function in conflict zones, but they are ill-equipped to handle sexual violence cases, which are often perceived as communal and not individual issues. And they are unable to hold government, rebel, or security forces to account, according to Antonia Mulvey, executive director of Legal Action Worldwide. When these entities act with impunity and are not held to account for their actions, the victims do not receive justice, says Deng.
There is no evidence of a single effective prosecution, and I think that in of itself, you know, says a lot.
To seek accountability from the perpetrators, the report's authors recommend legal and institutional reforms, proper vetting of security forces, and a means for the survivors to seek justice, such as through the formation of a hybrid court capable of trying war crimes. They also urge the drafting and passage of a sexual and gender-based violence bill. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Linus Rimkus, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Hello. Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Something special.